Book of the Month on Southside Broadcasting. Podbean.com. Probably the best download decision you'll ever make.
This month's book is Grass by Sherry S. Tepper. Sherry S. Tepper's Grass is one of the most enthralling works of science fiction I have ever read. Set on the planet of the same name, Grass follows the fortunes of the Raria family, sent as ambassadors to discover why this one world is immune to a universal plague that threatens to wipe out all mankind. The family have been chosen because on Earth they are nobles who keep horses and are famous equestrians. On Grass, the noble families, known collectively as the Bonds, also hunt, and it is hoped that this will give some common ground. On arriving, the family are shunned by most, and when finally allowed to witness a hunt, they realise this is a terrible mistake.
Before Rigo had a chance to meet the Green Brothers, a morning came when the Tell-Me shrilled news of the lapse. The Bon damfels had assembled for the hunt, but no hounds or mounts had appeared. Sulla, one of Roald Few's informants, had sent word to Commons, and Roald had messaged Opal Hill. Long-set plans moved into action. The embassy swarmed with cleaners and cooks, readying for the evening 3 days distant when the awaited reception would occur. In the little house, Eugenie bit through a thread and bid her docile Pet turn a quarter turn to the left. No one else at Opal Hill had seen Pet yet, and no one anywhere would have ever seen her like this. At the Bon Damfels, Stavanger ticked off the list of those who would attend. Chevlock, yes. Sylvan, yes. No one younger than Sylvan. None of the young cousins. Chevlock would be ordered to pay putative court to the Fragrass girl, Stella, and that would solve that problem. In Commons, the musicians went over their music and instruments. The wine merchant checked his stores. The extra cooks rolled their knives in their aprons. Air cars began to dart toward Opal Hill. At Bon Smerlock's estancia, and at Bon Tranlig's, at all the estancias, the grown women went through their ball gowns deciding what to wear, while their daughters sulked. None of the young women were going, it had been decided. Too dangerous. Only older women. Women with good sense. Women with a number of liaisons behind them. Several of them had been picked to flirt with the Iraria son. Several good-looking, experienced ones. Whatever else might occur as the result of Sanctity's embassy reception on Grass, an inappropriate liaison with a young Iraria was not going to be allowed. So said the elder Bonds. And at Opal Hill, Roderigo, or Iraria, went over the list of those who would attend, noting the absence of young people and simmering at the insult offered to his family and his name. Obermun Bon Hounser had remembered his promise to Marjorie when he had recommended Admit Malkadon as her secretary. When she first got round to interviewing the tall, self-important individual, he told her that he knew every Bon in every family and who the parents were and what the liaisons had been and who was in sympathy with and who out of sorts with whom. He expected, so he said, a private suite and a salary which made Rigo blink in surprise. "I don't trust him," Marjorie told Rigo. "Nor do I," Rigo confessed. "But hire him anyhow. Assign him something to do, and let's see what he comes up with." After a little thought, Marjorie asked Admit to compile a file on those who would attend the reception, giving family connections and such personal information as might be helpful to new acquaintances in conducting conversation. He spent a great deal of time at it for one who supposedly knew them all, presenting the final work with a flourish. Marjorie thanked him with a smile, which conveyed nothing but ignorance and appreciation. She and Rigo then gave the file to Person Pullet. "Oh, my lame left leg," Person muttered. "That fool doesn't know a cousin from an aunt, or a Bon Malkadon from a Bon Binderson."
Grass is home to cunning alien species who pose as hounds and hippia, hypnotising the Bonds into joining them on a day-long foray through the endless prairies, which leave them barely conscious and often badly injured. When Stella, the daughter of the family, joins the hunt against her mother's wishes, she fails to return at the end of the day. No one will help find her, and the Bonds act as if her disappearance should never be mentioned again. Marjorie, Stella's mother, will not accept this, and slowly the secrets of this beautiful but malevolent planet are uncovered.
At the Friary, while an air car was readied and certain accoutrements were assembled, assassins for the use of, elder brother Fouassi thought to himself, grimacing at his own private joke, Fouassi are stewed and steamed in his lonely office, thinking of a thousand ways the plans of the Mouldies might already have been forestalled, or, if not already, then imminently. Perhaps Sanctity had found out about him and had sent people. Perhaps the health authority on Semling had become aware of Mouldy plots. Perhaps Mainoa had talked to others. Perhaps the ambassador knew. He opened his desk drawer for the tenth time, searching for the book that wasn't there. Mainoa's book. Who had taken it? Had Jamlies taken it? That totally sanctified idiot? Had he? If he had, Jamlies would be messaging Sanctity about it. Messaging. Getting messages back. Like a message from the Hierarch saying, open the secret armory and take the planet for Sanctity. A message like that. Not that he knew there was a secret armory here in the Friary. Everyone said so, but then everyone could be wrong. Suppose the Green Brothers did take the planet, wipe out the Bonds and the Mounts and the Hounds. So then what would they do with it? They'd find a cure. That's what they'd do with it. Mainoa had seemed to think there was a cure here. They'd find it. Give them a little time. Fouassi had assumed there was plenty of time to spread the virus. He had not hurried. Now, Jamlies might be onto him, and urgency overwhelmed him. Yes, brothers Flumsy and Nyop and Sushli and Thisayam and Lilimamul should find that damned Mainoa and kill him. Kill Mainoa and Luri and anyone else who was with them. Yes, that should be done. At once. But there was one other thing that needed to happen at once. The distribution of the virus. In commons. That's where it would do the most good. That's where people were packed most closely together. He had delayed unconscionably. He had diddled. Uncle Shales would not have been proud of him. He took a small carrying bag from his cupboard, placed the packet of virus inside on top of a change of clothing, covered it with an additional robe which was all Shothal would need, left his office, and went down hay-smelling corridors to the gravel court, where he found Shuthai himself, just closing an engine housing. "Is it ready?" the elder brother asked. He stood back and regarded the air car with disfavour. It was one of the bigger ones, with two cabins, a large one up front and a private one behind, each opening to the outside. One of the smaller cars would have done as well and would have moved faster. Still, if it had been serviced... "Is it?" he repeated. Shuthai grimaced and giggled, said it was. There was something almost gleeful in his manner, and the elder brother assumed that the thought of Mainoa's destruction pleased Shuthai. Well, and it should. The thought of anyone's destruction pleased Mouldies. The more gone, the fewer left to go. So Mouldies said.
Tepper came to writing late in life, but completed more than 30 books before her death last year. They range from pure fantasy, such as the 9 books based on the True Game universe, where everyone is born with some magical talent, to mystery and horror stories published under another name. But her best work is from the science fiction genre. Grass is part of a trilogy of books exploring the impact of a theocratic government on mankind, the others being Raising the Stones and Sideshow. She also wrote a number of novels focusing on the idea of the other, how mankind might react to them, and looking at us through alien eyes. It is this ability to create the truly alien that is one of her greatest strengths, and coupled with a strong sense of humour, she highlights the many follies of our species while managing to always offer an alternative. She also managed to write possibly the best vampire story ever in The Gardener from 1988. Tepper has been labelled an eco-feminist writer, a label she happily accepted. But there is much more to her work than this. She won the Locus Award for Best Fantasy Novel in 1992 and received a World Fantasy Award for Lifetime Achievement in 2015. Never afraid to speak out against injustice or corruption, she was fierce and relentless in her opposition to misogyny, oppressive religious practices, and those who are polluting the planet, all within the framework of new and strange worlds, worlds both beautiful and occasionally horrific. I first encountered her books when I found a copy of the first three True Game novels in a shop in Hay-on-Wye. A year later, a friend gave me a copy of Grass, and it has been my favourite novel ever since. Whether you enjoy science fiction, horror, or dystopian fiction, Grass will enthrall you. I cannot recommend it more highly.
Being selected by Jenny Finch and her team for the Book of the Month is, quite frankly, one of the pinnacles of any writer's ambition.
Hi, this is Chase Masterson, founder of the Pop Culture Hero Coalition, the first ever organization to make a stand against bullying, racism, misogyny, LGBT bullying, cyberbullying, and other forms of hate using pop culture stories that we love. We all love superheroes. Why not be one? Check out our website at www.popculturehero.org. Follow us on Facebook at Pop Culture Hero Coalition and on Twitter at Superhero IRL. Thanks so much.
Strokes affect 130,000 people in England and Wales each year. Here's a recipe that can dramatically decrease your chances of strokes.
Excellent. I better get a pen.
167 grams of calcium, 225 grams of magnesium.
Hang on, slow down. One tablespoon.
Remember, any more than one tablespoon could kill you. Any less than one tablespoon could kill you.
Right, what was
and
the recipe?
That's the recipe.
Oh,
if you would like a more simple solution, you can always call Pharma Nord on 01670 519989.
All right.
Or visit the website pharmanord.co.uk.
Let me see if I can jot that down. What was the number again?
01670 519989. Or visit the website pharmanord.co.uk.
And how do you spell Pharma Nord, I wonder?
pharmanord.co.uk.
It's almost as if I'm having a conversation with the radio.
Don't be silly, that's impossible.
Pharma Nord, winning the war of nutrition.
You're listening to a Southside Broadcasting podcast. Southside Broadcasting is a media company which aims to provide a wide range of features from the rural, health and lifestyle worlds. You can regularly listen to entertaining podcasts with interviews and correspondence from Los Angeles, Nashville, New York and London. You can take part in our Book of the Month features, grab some great nutritional advice, enjoy broadcasts from the Great Yorkshire Show, the Lincolnshire Show, and enjoy local football reviews with our regular feature, Fly Me to the Moon. You can even hear a BAFTA award-winning director drive a train full of teddy bears. You can listen to these and many more podcasts at southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com. For further information on how you can join over 35,000 people who regularly download our podcasts, call us on 01642 854 742 or email info@southsidebroadcasting.com now.
In today's crowded world, it's sometimes hard to get heard. And sometimes you need a little extra push to be heard. That's where Manila PR can help. We specialise in online radio and press for independent bands, with prices to match, and have been doing so for the last decade. So if you have a noise to make, make it with Manila. Visit manilapr.com now.
You're listening to Jenny Finch, crime writer, scholar, and commentator, with another classic Book of the Month on Southside Broadcasting. crime writer. That means she authors the crimes. She's the mastermind behind the crimes. Oh, is this recording?
Yes, it was. Welcome, Rob Nichols, to Book of the Month for April 2017. And did you get through the long grass?
I did. I found it initially quite daunting because there's an awful lot of names that I'm glad it was that you were both pronouncing them. The first names are easy without Marjorie, but there's a lot of names, a lot of terms, there's a lot of complexity setting up the world as we're parachuted in, so to speak. There's an awful lot to go on, an awful lot to sort of get through and to get into your head. But as you get into the middle of the book, things start to slot into place, and it becomes quite fascinating as you sort of get engrossed in the world of grass.
Yeah, I mean, I found it, like yourself, Rob, hard going in various pages, a bit like going through treacle, not grass, just to work our way through that whole process. I was at times wondering how could Ursula K. Le Guin have actually said that Sherry S. Tepper takes the mental risks of the lifeblood of science fiction and all imaginative fiction. Obviously, she did say it, and that's why she's quoted as saying it. But it kind of worked. It worked on the basis of being influenced by a number of things. I think Dune, the Frank Herbert saga, I don't know if you've ever encountered that. That was one, I think, precursor that very much deals with regal families and issues related to that.
Everybody used to read it when I was at school. I remember that was the big hit at that time.
Exactly. And also an episode of Star Trek called Devil in the Dark, where you're at the Horta, who is a totally alien life form, misunderstood by the miners, who are effectively seeking its eggs. And they weren't seeking it, they were destroying the eggs and so on. So those were the kind of precursors that I felt were there. The pronunciations, I do wish that Miss Tepper had actually included a pronunciation device, because Raria is the Y silent. I think, Jenny, you had it as a silent Y. Yep. I had it as a slightly more pronounced Y. The Bonds, I think, were very much as in the European Von Trapp family, Bond this, Bond that, and so on. Did you have any characters that you sympathised with?
I certainly didn't sympathise with the husband. But Marjorie obviously was the heroine of the piece, wasn't she?
I was intrigued in terms of how the heroine was portrayed, because it took quite some time. I mean, the top of the actual science fiction masterworks that I use for this, the New York Times Book Review, one of the most interesting and likeable heroines in modern science fiction. Oh, really? Surely that must have been Aliens and Ripley and so on. I kind of got a sense at times that Marjorie was one of those characters for whom greatness happened to, as opposed to she actually actively seeking something out. She kind of coped with conditions as she was faced with, and then effectively said, "That's it, I've had enough."
Well, she had a bang on the head. That was a really, really, really curious episode where she'd either spoke to God or she'd got concussion, and it changed her personality, didn't it? Mm. And it was a really, really strange scenario where we're looking at a civilization that was too good to be good. And we got a lot of sort of theological questions on different levels, but then that was their own fault that they were wiped out. And then she's sending a message across to say that it almost sort of in some ways that war is necessary. Don't you think? That you've got to be
cleansing of the species.
Well, I'm not going to say cleansing, but it was almost their own fault. That civilization for being wiped out, but also that the response had to be aggressive. There had to be and it's quite kind of interesting how she's marrying that up with her Catholicism, and it's quite curious to sort of have a debate about Catholicism in a sci-fi world, in far into the future. It still exists and.
I mean, again, returning to Dune, obviously the characters of the Bene Gesserit sisterhood are very much from the archetypal religious aspects. I mean, Jenny, lots of elements here that we've already talked about, and Rob has just quite rightly raised the issue of religious debate and the concept of original sin, which is often developed, and indeed there's a debate at one stage as to whether the Foxen as an incarnation, are they likely to need absolution? We have the brothers that actually are going out there, we have the Moldies who believe that actually it's time we pressed the button and ended it all, because then we'll all be reincarnated, or these those. I mean, that kind of notion of we need to have a another tipping point where certain people will survive, certain people won't survive, and the Darwinian theory, again, very much to the fore. Was that part of the appeal for yourself?
I think it was. I think she has a very strong opposition to organised religions through all of her books. And sanctity is a sort of extreme Mormon type, collecting everybody's details to be saved religion. Mm. I don't believe she's saying we have to have a war to cleanse the species. I think more she's saying we need to breed out these aggressive instincts. We need to move beyond them somehow, and it's very difficult to actually do that, as you find out in the final rampage at the end.
Mm. How did you feel the hippi were portrayed? I mean, I had an image of velociraptors and the kind of equivalence to what Jurassic Park obviously sees as this kind of very much dinosaur-like terrible lizard characters, as opposed to horses.
Yes, they're obviously like a terrifying beast when actually seen for what they are.
They've got spikes and all sorts of areas within the system there. And as I think is fairly clear, Mr. Tepper, not a big fan of the hunting, shooting and fishing brigade. Because again, we clearly see that the aristocrats, they're very much portrayed as being not necessarily out of touch, but living in their own little world, and clearly not having a clue ultimately about the best way to actually go on. And it's the commons, the people who kind of live in their own town, that effectively have, if we dare say it, the humanity of the book
and the wealth actually, which is hidden in plain sight in so many ways.
So, Jenny, you had a tale about how one of your students was once provided with this book and had their minds blown about this. I think it's worth sharing because I possibly having heard this, I was thinking maybe I was expecting too much, but carry on.
It was a young art student who had been on at me for about 2 years to borrow the book, and I didn't want to lend it to him when he was only 15. When he rejoined the art college and he was 17, nearly 18, I lent him the book. Most art students don't read. They just look at you and go, is there a film? He took this book home on Friday night and he brought it back on Monday looking as if he'd been hit by a rock. And I thought, oh, it was too much for him. And he handed it back to me in silence. And just as he was leaving the room, he turned around, he said, does it go away? And I said, actually, no, I don't think it ever does. And in some ways, if you internalise a lot of the book, if you really relate to it, it doesn't go away. It does haunt you. And for the next couple of weeks, he spent every free minute he had, all his lunch times, he stayed late, and he tried to draw the hounds, the hippia, the foxen. And he said, she's described them, and yet I can't get them down. He was a very, very talented, very imaginative young man. Yes, there's elements of the velociraptor or the tyrannosaurus, but somehow you never can quite get them down. They slip away from your mind. And that's why I feel in some ways she's written something that is truly alien. You can't even visualise it in some ways.
Rob, did you find that echo permeates through the whole system? Did you wake up, in the middle of the night thinking, Middlesbrough will survive, bring on the hippie?
I didn't relate it to Middlesbrough's Premier League hopes, but no, it definitely really, really grips you. I thought, in addition to that, that a lot of the technology, she doesn't bother to describe. It's almost like you take it for granted what they are using to communicate. I don't think she describes what they are, and that's probably good, really. It's unnecessary. Mm-hmm. And there's times at the end when we're in the final chapter everything is developing towards a climax that she doesn't go into the same sort of detail that she did earlier on with hunts and things like that.
Yeah.
Because you just sort of sucked along with it, really.
Yeah. I think the most telling point for me, the most frightening thing for me, is when Marjorie takes her horses out into the grass, and she's been practicing dressage with them, and she comes across a group of hippie and a group of hounds, and they're mimicking the dressage, and they suddenly stop, and they look over their shoulders, and she sees that malevolence in their eyes. And that's the moment, I think, when the book tips over. If you've got that fight, suddenly grabs you, and you think, oh, my God, what is this?
Science fiction as a mode, of course, is well-versed in terms of allegory, in terms of metaphor. I'd probably actually say China Mieville's Embassy Town from 2011 is the closest in recent years that I can recall to having that total alienness of the host, as they're actually described. However, it has brought us round to our very own generations, not cosmic anomalies and so on, but Rob, what mark out of 10 would you give Sherry S. Tepper, the late Sherry S. Tepper, of course, passed away, I think, relatively recently.
22nd of October last year.
Yes, exactly. So she should at least have some sort of answer to the cosmological questions that she was posing in her writing here. What mark would you actually give the text?
I give it 9 out of 10.
I'm going to go 8 to 8.5. Little less than that. I suspect there's going to be a 10 coming up in some way, shape or form. But Jenny?
9.5.
Really?
9.5, because she's written one book that's better than this.
Ooh.
So, given that we won't be looking at Sherry S. Tepper's next book for the next book of the month, what have we actually got in mind for the listener and ourselves to share as far as the analysis of Book of the Month is concerned?
Right, for next month, book, I've chosen Alex Marwood's chilling and wonderfully written The Wicked Girls.
Being selected by Jenny Finch and her team for the Book of the Month is quite frankly one of the pinnacles of any writer's ambition. Don't ask me how I know this. I just do.